Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. People all around the world and right here in Michigan are rethinking money in order to ease financial woes, and they're doing it with local currency. On today's program, we find out what that is and where it's working. Then we head up north to a resort town where a vacation can lead to putting down roots and building a business. But first, a state Senate panel has voted to make more than 300,000 Michiganders eligible for Medicaid in 2014. And that isn't all. The GOP-led Government Operations Committee said yes to two alternative plans. So from the Senate ticking off Governor Snyder by adjourning without voting on the House-passed Medicaid expansion plan, to this Senate panel serving up not one, not two, but three Medicaid proposals, well, it's a lot to keep track of. Let's turn to Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing reporter, Jake Neer, and get a little help in sorting this all out. So, Jake, 6 weeks ago, the Senate heads home for its summer break. It does not vote on that House-passed bill. Governor Snyder actually flew home from Israel to issue a public scolding. So what happened to get things moving?
Well, they took a few weeks since they refused to vote on this. They threw it to a legislative work group who, it was made up of both Republicans and then some Democrats were actually added later. But they tried to hammer out a proposal that supposedly would get more support from Republicans in the Senate. And now they released the plan, recently, and honestly, not too many huge changes. It would still do basically what the proposal that the House passed would do. But there are, some technical fixes and some other things that Republicans apparently wanted in the Senate. It remains to be seen whether or not support will really grow for this new proposal, but it is moving now.
So assuming they are moving forward, it probably wouldn't be too hard, we might predict, to reconcile the two versions?
I have a feeling that if this version went back to the House, mm-hmm. You talk to Mike Shirky, who is one of the more conservative members of the House, who was really eventually got behind this bill. He says, they made some good changes. In fact, if anything, he says it's better than what they passed.
So, Jake Neer, tell us about the two alternatives. So you get three options, door number one, door number two, and door number three. What's behind two and three?
Well, these are very, very new proposals. In fact, just yesterday, before the committee hearing happened and they took up these proposals, they were just being referred to the committee right before the hearing, and then later on they passed. But, one of them is a plan that would take an almost entirely free market approach. In fact, an entirely free market approach. People would go the existing Medicaid population would go onto direct care plans with high deductibles in many cases. Mm-hmm. It's very complex. In fact, I talked to Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville afterward. Reporters asked him, do you understand this bill after it was passed out of your committee? He said, honestly, not completely, but it's a little, unorthodox. But he wants these plans to be part of the conversation going forward, and he doesn't want them to get bogged down in the committee process. Okay. And the other bill, too, is actually from Senator Bruce Caswell. And this one would expand coverage for low-income people who are that at this moment are not eligible for Medicaid, but are under the federal poverty level.
Okay.
And it would be completely state-funded. So no federal dollars. It wouldn't expand Medicaid. Governor Rick Snyder's administration, Department of Community Health Director Joe Haveman, and his budget director, John Nixon, both said at the hearing yesterday that both of these would be very costly plans to the state. And they actually said that the free market approach would actually be a complete dismantling of Michigan's healthcare system, especially Medicaid, as we know it today.
So don't look for Governor Snyder to be getting behind either of these two alternates.
Although, I actually just spoke to the governor today, and he said that he's happy that they passed all these proposals. He takes sort of the same attitude that Randy Richardville does. Both of them support the Medicaid expansion, but they say, we're being relentlessly positive, as they always say, and we're trying to keep the conversation going and keep these ideas floating.
So what do you hear from Randy Richardville? When does he expect a vote?
They are expecting to vote on Medicaid in late August. That's a hard goal. I guess I don't know deadline if that's the right word. But if they pass the Medicaid expansion bill, as I would say they expect to do, that also has to be approved by the House. It has to be approved by the governor, which, you know, would happen. But it also has to be approved by Washington. That's the big one. If they don't get these federal waivers in time, they can't start adding people to the Medicaid rolls in January 1 when the program is supposed to start.
And it goes without saying there are tens of thousands of people anxiously watching and hoping to get added to those Medicaid rolls. Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing reporter Jake Neer. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Cindy.
The federal farm bill is the focus of the latest political battle on Capitol Hill, and in that fight rests the future of SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. About 1.7 million people here in Michigan and 47.5 million people nationwide receive federal help to buy food. Spending and participation in the food stamp program in 2011 was at an all-time high. Well, funding for the food stamp program is part of the big five-year farm bill. Both the House and Senate have approved farm bills, but there's a big gulf between the two versions. The Senate's version would cut about $4 billion from food assistance programs. Senate Democrats say that would be enough to root out waste but not strand people in need. The House version would cut much deeper, around $20 billion. House Republicans say now that the economy's recovering, food assistance can be cut back. And many of them maintain President Obama's expansion of food aid during the recession went way beyond what was truly needed. So here's the $16 billion gap, and the clock is ticking because the Farm Bill and food stamp programs expire at the end of September. We wondered, what does this all mean for Michiganders who rely on federal food assistance? We turn now to Melissa Smith. She's a senior policy analyst for the Michigan League for Public Policy, a Lansing-based group focusing on social services. Welcome back to the program, Melissa.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So if the House and Senate cannot iron out that $16 billion gap in committee, what would it mean for the people in our state who rely on SNAP?
Unfortunately, the answer to that question at this point is still a big I don't know, and we don't know, because there's so many variables that could still occur, whether or not this goes down in conference committee. If it doesn't, there's possibility of trying to fund some of the programs through appropriations. But then that means a lot of the policy choices that might have been made by the legislators won't be included. So really at this point, what's different than has ever happened before, because the Farm Bill always tends to ruffle a lot of feathers up at the Capitol, and it always takes a while to get it through on its five-year cycle. But for the first time, we've got this Farm Bill that has come out of the House that split the nutrition program out of it entirely. And so what the House sent was only the part of it that dealt with agriculture and not that dealt with the nutrition programs that help so many poor families in this country. Fortunately, because the Senate version does have the nutrition title included, the conference committee can still come up with a final bill that includes the nutrition title in it. So it really comes down to what they're able to accomplish in that committee. There's been a lot of things that have been discussed between the House and the Senate regarding changes that have been suggested to be made to the SNAP program, including getting rid of some things that work around with what we call categorical eligibility, because so many families are on more than one government assistance program. They may be on cash assistance as well as food assistance, or on disability and food assistance, that we've kind of given states the ability to merge some of their eligibility requirements and allow for just one application or one set of requirements, and then you can get into several programs.
To streamline things.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of amendments have been made over the last few months to try and strip some of that ability out of the SNAP program. And that's the idea is that they're worried that some people might be getting food assistance that wouldn't be under the bill as it comes out of Congress because of the combinations that states have done with other programs. Of course, for the states, it saves them a ton of money. It's very efficient, and it also helps families get what they need and hopefully get on their way to self-sufficiency. So those have really been targeted, and that's where if the bills come out with some of the cuts proposed before slicing the nutrition title out entirely, we might see people dropped off because they had an eligibility that went through another program, but now they're not eligible for the food assistance program.
And what would that mean? I guess I'm trying to understand, as a bystander looking at all of this. It's confusing.
Yes. It is. Even if someone like me who's been doing this for many years, I will confess this has become very confusing because they've really gotten into so much of this real minutia of the program in, I think, an attempt to slice out fraud and abuse, and which, you know, we really feel is missing the mark on what the idea behind the categorical eligibility is, and that's just to help the state and to help people. One of the programs that has even been targeted has been an incentive program for the states to increase efficiency. That was in the original House bill of getting cut out of the SNAP program before they just eliminated the nutrition title entirely. Could also mean that some children will lose their eligibility for free and reduced school lunch.
Melissa, what is the vision in your mind as you work so hard to be a champion for vulnerable people and people who are impoverished and who need a helping hand? What is their image in your heart, in your mind? Because something very much drives you to care this much and to really be their voice.
Honestly, I grew up on cash assistance. I had food assistance. My mom was a single mother working two jobs and trying to go to school. And no matter where I've gotten in my life, I've always wanted to remember where I came from and made sure that so many people that I know and love don't have a voice in all of this. And I want to make sure that there are voices to protect people that don't necessarily have the ability to protect themselves.
That was Melissa Smith. Melissa is a senior policy analyst for the Michigan League for Public Policy. And she joined us today from Lansing. Melissa, thank you so much. Always good to have you on the program.
Thank you. It was lovely talking to you.
Still to come, how could local currency help Michigan cities? We'll find out in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, you recall on yesterday's program, we talked about the prospects for a self-driving car. So let's continue our conversation about the future of personal transportation. Writer Mickey Maynard is looking at what's happening all over the country in terms of how we're getting from point A to point B, and she sees big changes on the way. Mickey is the former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, and she's authored four books, including The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Industry. Now she has a new project in the works, a proposed ebook she calls Curbing Cars. Mickey Maynard joins us now in the studio. Welcome back.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
So we have spoken to you on Stateside before about what you see coming down the road in terms of personal transportation. So what's the story that you want to tell with Curbing Cars?
The story that I want to tell is why people are driving less and why we're rethinking the way we get around. So it used to be that the only way most people got around was either their car or maybe they took a bus or public transportation. We don't have as much of that in this listening area.
But if you live in Chicago or New York, you totally understand that.
Exactly. And one of the things that I think I'd like to point out is that this is something folks have noticed in the younger generation. So in high school kids, college kids, people just graduating, you know, car ownership among what's called the millennials is way down. But there's also another factor, which is the under end of the market among baby boomers. People are selling their big suburban houses and moving into the city. And when you move into the city, you probably have one parking space. So you're maybe not getting rid of a car completely, but you're have a smaller fleet. And then you also might take a bus, or if you live in Chicago or New York and San Francisco, you can jump on the subway. So everyone is thinking more about their personal transportation needs.
So even though the old model, the traditional model of someone getting into a car, one person, and driving, that seems to be the big baby boomer bubble, doesn't it?
It does. It's baby boomers, their parents, and a little bit of Gen X, because we had a lot of folks who had children and bought minivans and small SUVs. So,
but then you move to the younger crowd.
Lower, and then folks rely on their bikes. People walk. People use skateboards. And the interesting thing is to look at the number of young people who are not getting their driver's licenses. Because if you don't get bit by that car bug before you're about 20, it's going to take a while before you have the money and the time to be interested in cars.
So what do you think this means to automakers and especially to the economy here in Michigan?
This is the big question, because I don't see the car going away. I don't think the Detroit companies are necessarily in trouble from this, but what it might do is limit their future growth. So let me give you an example. Back in the last decade, before we got into the recession, people were saying we were headed to sell 20 million cars a year, probably by 2010. The recession came along and we went from about 17 million to about 9 million. Mm-hmm. So we're building ourselves back. Mm-hmm. We're getting back to about 15 million, which is called trend in the auto industry. So 15 million is healthy, but we're nowhere near 20. And what I think is going to happen is we could bump along about where we are for the foreseeable future.
And that's what I was wondering. How far or how near into the future do you think this sea change is going to be happening?
One of the interesting things about this millennial generation is how big they are. Some people think they're as big or bigger than the baby boomers. So you have a situation where the big blob of folks, you know, in their late 40s and up, we're still going to be buying cars. Mm-hmm. But everyone expected that our kids would come along, graduate from school, and follow us into the car market. That's not happening. And what I'm interested in seeing is, when do those folks buy cars? Is it late 20s, early 30s? Do they wait even longer? Do they not even bother?
And we're seeing things like Zipcar. And then we were just in New York at the end of May, and they had just launched the bike sharing with their city bikes. Am I right? That has just exploded in New York.
Right. So City Bikes has only been around for a couple of months, and they've already recorded about 1.5 million rides. It took the system in Boston is smaller. They just got to a million after 2 years. Now, the big, big leader is Paris. So Paris is where all of this started back in 2007. They've recorded 173 million rides. There is one rental bike for every 97 people in Paris, and that compares with one for about every 8,000 people in New York. So just think of where Paris is and where our American cities are, and we have a great big mountain that we can climb, but the opportunities are endless.
And explain how it works for those who aren't familiar or didn't hear about this this bike sharing and with city bikes.
So in a lot of places, what happens is you can buy an annual membership. So for example, if you buy a membership in Chicago, it costs you about $75 a year. And then for that, you get half an hour free. So if you want to ride from, say, Navy Pier over to the Loop, you jump on a bike, you either have a key tag, like the kind that opened your car, or you punch in a code, and you get on a bike, you ride it over, you drop it off in a bike rack, and you're done. So for your $75 a year, you've gotten 30 minutes on a bike at any one time. If you want to ride it a little longer, then you pay by the hour. And then for tourists or visitors, you pay about $7 or $8 for a 24-hour pass. You get that 30 minutes free, and then you're paying by the hour again. Obviously, you know, they've got your credit card, and so if you run off with the bike, you're going to have a $2,000 bike. So it's probably not worth it to take the bike home. But some places are actually subsidizing this. So the program in the city of New York is a joint venture with Citibank. The one in Chicago is run by the Chicago Department of Transportation. San Francisco Bay Area is just about to get a bike share plan that goes from Oakland to San Francisco all the way down to San Jose. And there's something like five governments involved in this. So as the governments figure this out, it's becoming a perk for their citizens as well as visitors.
Now, I think programs like that would work in your New Yorks and your Chicagos, but here in, let's say, in Michigan, let's talk about Southeast Michigan.
Sure.
We're all sprawled out, so don't we have to have our cars?
Well, the cool thing about it is that Dan Gilbert in Detroit literally just started a bike sharing program free for his employees. So if you work for Quicken Loans or Rock Financial, you can ride a bike sharing bike free. for free. Now, I think there's going to be a little bit of envy by people in Detroit who are watching all these Quicken people zipping around Detroit on their bikes. So that's a corporate perk. So sure, a lot of us have to commute to work. A lot of us drive 30 miles, 45 miles into the city. But once we get to the city, say you work in the GM building and you want to ride up to Comerica Park. What if GM had a program, or what if there was a city program? You don't, but maybe you take the people mover, but maybe you're ready for a bike ride. So it could work that way.
That's writer Mickey Maynard. You can learn more about her project at curbingcars.com, or you can follow at curbingcars on Twitter. Mickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's turn now to art, bringing new life back into downtown Pontiac, one brushstroke at a time. That's the mission of a new business called the Artist Lounge. It strives to use the power of art to touch lives and also boost an Oakland County city that has had its share of struggles. Wendy Fournier is the co-founder of the Artist Lounge on Saginaw Street in downtown Pontiac. Wendy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cindy. Thanks for having us.
Wendy, what does the Artist Lounge offer to people in the Pontiac area?
It offers a new art experience and actually new nightlife, a new hot spot. Not only does it teach art for all ages, five and up, we have like a new night on the town where we kind of combine painting and wine, wine tasting, and where you're creating a painting at the same time.
Get into a little more about what you feel is different and what you want to do that's different from other places. And there are places around Oakland County where you can come in and do an art project. But what did you and your partner want to do that was really different?
We truly want to impact the community through art. We started, Wendell and Wilson and I, we started a mobile company called Right Brain Projects, where we actually stimulated the right side of the brain to increase like efficiency at work, more of like a professional development, like a research-based product. And people were so blown away by the results. It was such an esteem builder. So with that company, we really saw how art can really impact people's lives directly. You know, they were able to do things that they never thought were possible. So part of that vision was always creating this Artist Lounge, where we teach art in such an unconventional way that people are totally blown away with the results, and that's, I think, the difference that we bring here. And not to mention, we're very entertaining at the same time, so they have such a great time in a very relaxed environment where they truly are blown away every time they have a class with us in what they can produce.
I'm sure you're seeing this, that more and more, as school districts are forced to make cuts, the kind of programs that are cut are your art and your music kind of programs, so people are coming out of school without having the same art experiences that you may have had.
Exactly, and that's exactly why we want to be in Pontiac, you know. Our programs were cut, you know, in the elementary schools, and so we feel like it's kind of filling that need. And the way that we teach it is unconventional, and even the kids are blown away with their own abilities to be able to produce these things, and their parents are like, wow, I can't even believe my child was able to do that. So definitely we feel there's a need in Pontiac, and it is through the right side of the brain, activating the right side of the brain, where I feel like we will be able to, you know, rise above the competition, you know, the outside-of-the-box thinking. You know, we focus in our culture on the left side and the right side through art. You can really kind of blow yourself away with your own potential, unlock your own hidden potential with that, start listening to your own inner voice.
The power of art.
The power of art, truly.
I'm speaking with Wendy Fournier, who's co-founder, actually, of the Artist Lounge on Saginaw, right in downtown Pontiac, a place to come hang out, mix entertainment with expressing yourself through art and trying to reach the community, and also to help downtown Pontiac. What kind of community have you found as you have chosen to put your business in downtown Pontiac?
Beautiful community. I have met so many people that are inspiring me. I love being a part of what's happening in Pontiac. There's so much energy down there. There's so many people that are about moving it forward, rebirthing it, reviving it. There's so much potential in Pontiac because it's surrounded by so many successful cities. And it's people from these cities and even within it that believe in what Pontiac has to offer. That I've met with Bob Wan and James Riley. They've honestly given us this opportunity to create this art studio down there. They're part of the Indian Hill Group, and they're partnering us with a bakery and a wine shop so we can offer our customers beautiful bread, beautiful wine tastings while they're painting. But it's these people that believe it. We can't do it, you know, as a business. We're really not about profit here. We're really about building the community up, bringing Pontiac back into this central art focus that it used to have, that it has with music. We were going to bring it back. So many people that can feel the energy in Pontiac and that believe in it. It's not going to take just one person. It's going to take all of these people. And I've been so fortunate. Wendell and I have been so fortunate in just being a part of this experience.
Wendy Fournier is the founder of the Artist Lounge. It's on Saginaw in downtown Pontiac in a six-story old building that sounds very, very cool with raw brick and weathered wood. And you can check out the Artist Lounge on their website at theartistlounge.biz. Wendy, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us.
On every great vacation, there's that aha moment when you think, we should move here. Well, Northern Michigan is dotted with B&Bs, cafes, and art galleries run by vacationers who never left. New ones open every summer, and every summer, plenty of them go bust. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells talks to the people who are actually courageous or crazy enough to make the leap.
In places like Petoskey or Harbor Springs, locals see this kind of thing all the time.
People want to do bees, or people want to do cider, hard cider. You know, oh, let's get into that business. I'll just read a book and then be able to do it.
This is Bonnie Hill. She's a kitchen designer. She lives full year in Harbor Springs. So she knows that there are three things stacked against any business up north. And to get into them, we're actually not going to use kitchen design as our example. We're going to focus on art galleries. Two reasons why. One, it's the kind of ultimate up north fantasy job. Think about it. You can't swing a stick without hitting a gallery up north. And two, because they are such a sink or swim business. So why do they sink?
Bad art.
I'm sorry.
This is Margaret Tweeden. For 18 years, she has owned Tweeden Fine Art Gallery in Harbor Springs. Yeah. And that's especially impressive when you consider that here, gallery years are like dog years. Their lifespans are just that short.
Just about every summer, galleries close. Sometimes they last a year, sometimes they last 2 or 3 years, but they think they just can put a couple paintings on the wall and that's it. Well, it's not that.
All right, so here is the first risk for resort town businesses. You are totally dispensable.
I don't sell, you know, bread and milk. I sell luxury items that people don't need.
Problem number two. You have 6, maybe 8 weeks to make all of your money for the year. Seriously, that's how short peak season is, which means that you are the only people up north who hate sunny days.
You know, people on the boats, on the golf course, it's not good for business. It's not. We like a rainy day. Rainy days are great.
This is Bernie Schaefer. We are sitting in his wife's gallery. Her name is Elizabeth Polly. It's appropriately named the Elizabeth Polly Fine Art Gallery. And they take some time to talk to me about how Schaefer works just down the street. He's in the real estate business. And it turns out that they see a lot of similarities between their two industries. You spend a ton of time making personal connections. And you're pouring hours of work into a deal that may never pay off. So I asked Schaefer, is there anything that's actually harder about your wife's gallery business than the real estate industry?
She has to educate people more. You have people who buy art because it matches their couch. She is trying to tell people that it's not about what's in it. It's about the quality.
Then Schaefer looks at his wife's face, realizes this is a less than flattering description of customers, and says, I'm probably going to get slapped.
I'm probably
going to get slapped.
But he does have a point. Up north, fine art sellers are all competing with each other to make the sale. Think about it. There are only so many summer home people with thousands of dollars to drop on a painting, much less many paintings. So new businesses, almost by definition, don't have the connections and the reputation that they need to survive.
The way the things go, I think we'll move next year to go somewhere else.
This is Blagojcha Stroyanovsky. He's just a few blocks away from the other galleries, and he should be doing great. But now Stroyanovsky says he wishes he had never fallen in love with Northern Michigan.
I feel like I get stuck too.
You feel like you got stuck?
Yeah, we spend maybe 40,000-50,000, and there is no business here.
The hard truth is that there is business for some galleries. It's just not easy. And it's definitely not as romantic as it looks. It's not swanning around your own gallery, surrounded by art and beauty. But of course, the siren song of a life up north, that is not going away anytime soon. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. So do you have a favorite gallery in Northern Michigan, perhaps a B&B, perhaps a cafe? Share it with the rest of us. You can do it very, very easily. We always love to hear from you here on Stateside. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, always on the website, michiganradio.org. Coming up next, in the face of crushing money troubles, there is a call for Detroit to think outside the box, perhaps look to local currencies, and then we hear how one Michigan city is making that work. I'm Cynthia Canty, and you're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Detroit makes unhappy history by becoming the biggest city in American history to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection, the focus has been on money and how the city doesn't have enough of it to meet its crushing obligations. There are financial experts who believe the troubles facing Detroit and many other cities and states is a warning that we as a society need to rethink our monetary system and look at the advantages of another kind of currency, a local currency. What's wrong with our current money system, and how would local currency help solve many problems? For the answers, we turn to the co-author of the book, Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. Jackie Dunn is a currency expert and a journalist, and she joins us now from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to the program, Jackie.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you today.
Well, the book states it right there on page one. It's time to rethink money. Why?
Because our system is not working for us. Let's think about it. According to the IMF itself, they've said that in the last 40 years between 1970 and 2010, there have been no less than 425 different types of systemic crisis. Everything from sovereign debt that we read all about in Greece and in Italy, to where the actual currency itself has failed. And, of course, we went through a terrible time ourselves here in the United States with the banking crisis of 2008. So this is not just, gee whiz, a problem that happens once in a while. It is a systemic problem.
And what was your reaction when you heard that Detroit had filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection?
I was so saddened because I've spent some time in Detroit and I have a lot of friends in Michigan. And knowing that if people really understood what money truly is, there would be no need for anybody, not even a city, never mind individuals, having to declare bankruptcy. But bankruptcy is part and parcel of our system and how it was devised about 400 years ago.
So give us a sense, explain to us how the current system of money is failing us. You say that it's not serving us as it should be. We're serving it.
Indeed. It's because there isn't sufficient money to go around. And there couldn't be because it is bank debt-based. Money is created when somebody goes in for a loan, such as for a house or a motorbike or whatever else. And it has to remain scarce in order for it to maintain its value. If they printed sufficient money for everybody to take care of their needs, I'm not talking about running around buying Porsches, just take care of their needs.
Sure.
There would be hyperinflation and the currency would be worthless. So part and parcel of the system, how it was devised 400 years ago in a very different age with a very different set of sensibilities, it was brilliant, but it doesn't serve us today.
And the solutions for scarcity of money is certainly something we have seen or likely will see in Detroit. And we can look anywhere in the world where problems have hit with money, and you see austerity measures and cutbacks and privatizations. Mm-hmm. Why is all of that the wrong medicine, in your view?
Because by creating other currencies, it is possible for people to have sufficiency. We're talking about sustainable abundance. Can I give you an example of currency?
Yes.
Let me take a town, a city that was going through terrible problems. It was Curitiba, Brazil. And the mayor of that town had a horrendous problem because there was so much garbage, particularly in the favelas. These are the shanty towns that had grown up on the peripheral of the town. He had no money to clean up that area. But he did have a bus service that was running half empty. So he sent out a notice to the favela saying, for every bag of straightened out garbage between organics and tin and paper and glass, the people would get a token to ride the buses. Lo and behold, within a matter of weeks, the favelas were picked clean. They put the sorted out garbage into big vats, different color depending on the variety, and they started using the buses. Then the local farmers started accepting these bus tokens in payment for local produce. The mayor linked an unused resource, which is the willpower and energy of the people, with an unmet need, which was to clean up the favelas, and he created a currency. So if you look around, there are so much in terms, there's so much in terms of people's ability. People are underemployed, unemployed. There are so many unused resources, and we have a whole pile of unmet needs. By rethinking money, like Jaime Lerner, the mayor of Curitiba, did, he can actually resolve the problem. And what's furthermore, he designed several other currencies in this city, and within about a six-year period, the average person living in Curitiba, Brazil, had a standard of living that was one-third higher than anybody else living in any other part of Brazil. So it's not just a cute little anecdote. There actually are tangible results that actually show up in people's pocketbooks.
Well, when I think of this, so this is what you call a complementary or cooperative currency.
Mm-hmm.
And you also point out in your book that there are 14 states that have taken action to create their own state currency.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering how this works if you live in another town.
Mm-hmm.
Does it not cause walls to go up, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
No. What happens is we're not saying let's replace the dollar. We're saying we need all these different currencies working in tandem. That's why they're called complementary. They work in tandem. So obviously, you know, if I would buy my petrol in U.S. dollars because that's something that's bought from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at neighborhoods and you look at towns, if they had their own currency and they had like a negative interest rate on the money, meaning that the money expires or there's a it's not worth as much at a certain date, it is a pure medium of exchange. Which means I don't want to hoard it. It's not something that I make my savings in.
So I'm not going to put it under the mattress.
No, it's not that. I do it in other things. I do it in dollars. I do it in gold. I do it in land. I do it in my house. Do it in other things. But I would have a pure medium of exchange. So I would go out into my community, go to the hairdressers, go to the cinema, go to restaurants, you know, support local products and services. And this, they have shown that with a local currency with a negative interest rate, that money circulates 20 times, as much as 20 times faster than the regular dollar or an ordinary currency.
I'm speaking with Jackie Dunn. She's a currency expert, and she's a journalist and the co-author of the book Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. So as we talk about local currencies, I'm wondering, Jackie, who sets the value of the services?
Money resides in the space of an agreement. So it's an agreement within a community to use something standardized as a means of exchange. You're not obliged to take it, but if you choose to, you can actually negotiate. So how is it different from barter? Barter is, I'll come over and cut your grass and you give me a half dozen eggs.
Right.
But say if you don't like my gardening skills, and trust me, you won't, Cynthia, we can't do that. We can't do that transaction. So in order to buy the half dozen eggs, I need money. So it facilitates commerce. And what we're saying is there's not just one currency to facilitate commerce. There are several currencies you could have. For example, Switzerland. a shining example, I think you would agree with me, as a very stable economy.
Yes.
It is because they have had for 80 years, almost 80 years, a complementary currency, a business-to-business complementary currency. And how it came about was in 1934, in the depths of the Depression in Switzerland, 17 businessmen who used to meet very regularly had all received notices from their respective banks saying that their line of credit had either been completely cut or severely cut back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of looking at each other, what are we going to do? And they realized that they were actually trading with one another. They were going to the bank to get a loan in order to pay one another. So they set up a currency between themselves called the WIR, W-I-R, which means we, us in English.
Mm-hmm.
And they started trading in that. So if I sell you something, Cynthia, I get a credit, you get a debit. And then you take your, you know, you try to get a credit, so your ledger is comes to zero. So you actually, you know, trade among yourselves. It's an accounting system.
And who manages all of this?
It's a cooperative. And the reason why it is so successful, and 16% of all commerce between small and medium-sized enterprises in Switzerland take place in the WIR economy. So they deal with WIR when the banks aren't lending or they need extra money or whatever else. So the beautiful thing about the cooperative is I will adhere to the guidelines of the cooperative, because the worst thing that can possibly happen to me is that I'm expelled from the cooperative and I actually lose my ability to use this currency, which is a very big deterrent.
You say in your book, Rethinking Money, there are about 4,000 communities with a mature system of cooperative currency in place. Are there any successful systems you could point us to in Michigan or in the U.S.?
There are many, and I think the most successful system, I mean that a design of currency, mm-hmm. is time banking, which is a currency that is backed by time, and that's something that we can all understand. 1 hour service equals one unit. And it has become very successful. It's actually now operating, I think, in 37 countries all around the world. So there are many examples of time banking in Oregon. There are legal services where they give free legal services, but they have a pay-it-forward mechanism. So people will go into the community and earn time dollars as a way and pay them forward as a way of saying thank you for the services they've gotten. You know, there's bicycle repair in San Francisco using time banking. I mean, you name it. There is a way to pay for a service using something like time banking or some other currency.
So if this all seems to be working so well, it makes me wonder why it isn't more widely used.
That's a very interesting question. We're in the early days of flight, like the Wright brothers, and there has been this amazing confluence of cheaper computing, access to the internet so people could have information, social media, etc. It is growing. It is growing, I would say, consistently. And I think as people realize that there are other monetary agreements possible and they can see how well they function, I think more people will get on board. But I think people have had to feel the pinch before they realize, oh my gosh, is there another way of handling our affairs?
When communities have implemented these cooperative currencies, Jackie, where has the resistance come from? Has there been pushback from the banks or...
Yes, there has been pushback from the banks, and I think for the most part, it has basically gone ignored because it has been so much under the radar. In the case of Switzerland, I spoke to you about, and there was a big pushback from the banking industry, but they lost because it was so popular. But I think there has been a lack of information, and people have never, you know, it's a real approach avoidance money. Money, for most of us, can be an issue of shame, or if you have a lot of money, it really erodes trust. Also, the whole science of economics and monetary affairs are so blessedly dry. So there has been an innate desire not to address money for personal reasons, and also that it has been so convoluted, the language is so convoluted. So I do think as we move forward and more people see the success of this, they will be willing to embrace it. And there's all kinds of currencies. There could be taking care of elderly people, educating our young. There could be regional currencies, bioregional currencies, business-to-business currencies. It is endless in terms of the possibilities.
So to cities like Detroit, drowning in deficits and drowning in red ink, your advice would be?
My advice would be is to rethink money and see what the unused resources and the unmet needs are of the city. And I'm sure there is a very, very long list. And how the city could rebuild itself by accepting partial payment of taxes in the local currency so people could fill the coffers of the municipality with a local currency, and they in turn can pay their employees, such as, you know, the maybe the teachers, the policemen, the firemen, whatever else, in partial payment with these currencies, it would start to really ignite the economy.
Currency expert Jackie Dunn. She's the co-author of the book Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. Given us a lot to think about, Jackie, thank you so much. She joined us today from Boulder, Colorado. Thanks for being on the program, Jackie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So if you're still a little unclear as to just how a local currency would work in our everyday lives, well, we're about to find out. I'm joined now by a Traverse City resident. She works at Oriana Natural Food Market, where they use and exchange a local currency called Bay Bucks. Dina Ames works at Oriana Food Market, and she joins us now from Traverse City. Welcome to the program, Dina.
Hello, hello.
What does a Bay Buck look like, and how does it work?
They're actually very pretty, and they're kind of thick textured, and it's a real-life currency. People use it in equal exchange for the Federal Reserve notes, and you use them just like you would your dollars, fives, tens, twenties.
Is it accepted other places besides Oriana Food Market?
Oh, yeah. There is a directory. If you go online, there's a directory where you can find different businesses, and a lot of the town does accept Bay Bucks, you know, a lot of the locally owned people, but it's really great for, like, the farmers markets and individuals like myself. I'm a massage therapist as well as working at Oriana, and I accept Bay Bucks because I know I can spend them where I want to buy regular food, shoes, books, whatever.
Okay, help us understand, for those of us who are not familiar with local currencies, what do you get from using a Bay Buck that you don't get from using one of Uncle Sam's greenbacks?
It's kind of a pride and the security of knowing that you're supporting your community, that money is going to stay right inside your local area, that it's not going to be exchanged outside of the country, it's not going to be outsourced. You know that you're supporting your local people that you see every day. It's just really a good feeling.
And have they been embraced by consumers?
It's still a struggle, but yes. Oriana's kind of the hub. Kind of, we call it the Bay Buck Bank, because we do so much transaction. We do a lot of exchange with it. We have people that come in and buy Bay Bucks, you know, just to use out in their store. But where it's being used, it's very strong.
So if I walked into Oriana and I spent 15 Bay Bucks on a $13 purchase, would I get change in Bay Bucks, Dina, or would I get
You would get the whole denomination. You would get a dollar in Bay Bucks back, and then your change in regular coinage, Federal Reserve coinage.
Now, is that awkward for folks working at the stores to have to juggle that or keep that straight, or does it work out all right?
No, it works out fine. It's simple enough, and so when we use Bay Bucks, it's registered right in the final tally of the day how many Bay Bucks we use, and it's kept separate from Federal Reserve. But since we pay a lot of our own independent contractors, like the window washers, the musicians, that sort of thing in Bay Bucks, it all evens out.
So people don't mind getting paid in Bay Bucks?
No, because people that use them are the ones that would be more likely to frequent the farmers markets, the massage therapists, the, you know, the small independents in town that use them.
For more information on Traverse City's local currency, you can actually go to their website, baybucks.org, find out more about that. And I've been speaking with Dina Ames, who works at Oriana Food Market in Traverse City. Dina, thanks so much for talking with us today, and enjoy that beautiful Traverse City area.
I do every day. I am very grateful for it.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Tony Brown. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Soha, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.